You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. But boy, is that wind weird.
It is, sparkling, clear, and sunny from mountain range to mountain range here in Northern California. The temperature, let's back up here. We are recording this on January 8th, 2025 for broadcast on January 9th. And it's 48 degrees here in the mid-morning in the Davis-Dixon area, going up to a high today of 60 degrees, which is about 6 to 7 degrees above our average high temperature at this time of year. So looking back at last year, at this point, it was raining. We were in El Nino. We're not officially in La Nina, I don't think, but we're sure following that pattern this year. It is dry and sunny and going down to a low tonight of 38 degrees with fog possibly developing about sunrise. Day of the broadcast will be 62 degrees and sunny. Thursday night, 39 degrees and clear. Friday, 59 degrees and sunny. Friday night, 42 degrees and clear. Saturday, sunny and then breezy. Well, again, I guess. Saturday night, 38 degrees and clear. Sunday, 57. And basically, no rain on the horizon for the next 5 to 10 days. We've got a big ridge blocking everything, and it looks like that may be the long-term pattern for the month of January, or at least a good portion of the month of January for Northern California. I have to say, the wind here is annoying. The Santa Ana winds in Southern California are tremendous would be the term I would use, except it sounds positive. The fire down there deadly. is deadly. It's a horrible fire that's happening. One of the strongest Santa Ana winds they've seen in the month of January. I grew up in Southern California. We didn't have Santa Ana winds in January. We didn't even have them in December when I was a kid. So this is an interesting pattern, and it's terrifying for our listeners down there in Southern California. We're certainly thinking about you. And this is going to go on for a couple of days from the looks of it, unfortunately. And the air quality is apparently really terrible. As for our area, it looks like, you know, we've been having a little bit of frost when it's not windy here each day on our farm, getting to about 34, 35 degrees. It looks like frost again early next week after the winds stop. The nighttime temperatures are showing 36 or 37, but the surfaces can get cold enough to show some frost. People ask about this, and it's nothing at all to be concerned about. The plants that we're growing are certainly fine with those kind of temperatures. The main thing is, we like to tie the weather into your gardening. I'm having to do some watering right now. Not a lot, but I'm having to water, of course, things in containers. At our nursery, we're having to water, you know, every day the smaller plants, the bare root things that are in bins of shavings and sand at some of the other nurseries are needing water every day. If you recently planted a bare root tree, it does not need daily watering, but please check it. You know, the last couple of years have been so wet that getting bare root in the ground was very challenging, and you barely had to water them at all. Now, with at least a week or more of no rainfall and not even clouds or particularly all that much fog and dry winds occurring intermittently, you should check the watering daily. May not need it, more likely every few days, but bare root drying out is one of the worst things that can happen to it. So back during the mega droughts we had over a 10-year period, two major droughts, we got to the point with bare root fruit trees when people were buying them that we said, please give this plant 1 gallon of water every day because there was no rain happening. In years past, we would say, plant this, water once, don't worry too much about it. Well, that was when we had normal rainfall. So In this instance, keep an eye on the watering. My experience right now, things that I've been putting in the ground for the last 1 to 2 weeks, I've watered once very thoroughly, and I'm about to water again 5 to 7 days later. So that's just requesting that you check the soil, which you wouldn't think you'd have to do in the month of January. KDRT is community radio. We rely on funds from folks like you to pay for our operating costs and keep the station on the air. If you like what you hear, if you like the Davis Garden Show and all the other great programming here at KDRT, just head over to kdrt.org and click on the support button.
So we have an email from Matt who writes, I am living in Winters. And for those of you not in the area, Winters is near Davis, but on the other side of the valley. When is the best time to graft citrus and stone fruit? I'm hoping to give it a try. Any tips or suggestions? I love your show. Thanks.
Citrus, we generally wait till temperatures are hitting around 70 degrees, is my understanding, 70 to 80. So they're a subtropical plant. So grafting them in freezing or potentially freezing weather has never been what I've read or heard as being best. You just want to hold off until, let's say, mid to late February or March. If you get into weather that's really hot and dry, it's just more challenging for the graft to take. So you're a little early on citrus. Stone fruits can be grafted and budded midwinter, which is now. So that's the sequence would be the deciduous things are done while they're dormant, budding or grafting, and then citrus, we just wait until a little later in the season, perhaps the end of February.
And this is from Braden. And I bought a house in Woodland about 6 years ago and have been gradually converting the sensible low water landscaping and lawn to fruit and flowers. My goal is to pick fresh fruit every day of the year and to have year-round bloom, which is a riot of color. I have made great progress with the flowers, but daily fruit is still a distant goal.
If you go to redwoodbarn.com, I've moved this to the homepage. There's a chart that shows fruit ripening by month, the entire year around. So you can go there and you can look at, oh my goodness, look at all these things I can plant. Well, he's well on his way. Go ahead.
Okay. And he lists all the things that he's planted. And I'm not going to read them because there's so many questions down here at the bottom. He says, I should note these trees have not been pruned like a fruit tree. Two trees start branching around waist high and one around shoulder high. I prefer to keep their current structure and not take them down to knee high as they might be in a full orchard. I have a few questions about what is possible. And he's talking about... I have begun to eye the three red leaf plum trees, photos attached, that were planted by a former homeowner 9 to 12 years ago, and wonder if I might convert them into multi-graft stone fruit trees. I would like to grow pluots, apricots, and more varieties of peaches and plums, or even almonds. I have heard about people grafting many varieties onto one tree, and I was thinking that would be a fun project to turn one of the, or more of these trees into a Frankenstein tree with as many varieties as possible. I've been watching videos about grafting and top work and have practiced making grafting cuts and water sprouts from the red leaf plum, though I haven't tried grafting any of them yet.
Yeah, it's certainly possible to do. I know someone who lived in Woodland who was a member of the Rare Fruit Growers, which is going to where we're going to refer you since you're already aware of it, who had over 100 varieties of plum and pluot on a single red leaf plum that had come with the house. And he looked at that sort of silly red leaf plum that a lot of the builders like to put in just as a decorative tree. And he was very active in the Rare Fruit Growers, so he kept acquiring, budwood for different varieties and just started grafting them on there and periodically would post a picture. Oh, now I have 50, now I have 60. To the point that the only issue with it is, and I'll mention this for you as well at the start of this discussion, keeping track of them all is a little challenging. He would hang little tags, of course, little labels on each branch that was a particular variety. And I can only imagine how difficult it was to keep all of those straight, but at least some kind of color coding or something, enamel paint, a little dash of enamel paint at the base of it, and then keep a track in a journal somewhere of exactly which color refers to which variety would save you some trouble, let's say 3 to 5 years down the road as you get in there and try to figure out exactly which is which. But yes, you can do this. In the industry, we call them fruit cocktail trees. I don't think Frankenstein tree would sell as well, except perhaps to a narrow demographic, but a fruit cocktail tree, you can Pretty much, and I'm not going to say all the stone fruits are compatible. There's issues about which ones are and which ones are not. But if it's a plum, pluot, apricot, those are relatively closely related and certainly work together. And you can try some of the others as well. Let's move on now.
Well, now, before we get any further, how big does a tree have to either be when you do this or grow to in order to support all of these other fruits? Because apricot trees are bigger than a red bud, red
Redleaf
plum,
plum.
isn't it?
They are. Well, this is the issue we had when we had a pruning service, when we would do fruit tree pruning for people, and we'd get out and someone would have a fruit cocktail tree or was an amateur grafter and budder. We would find that the ones where it's a real mix of things, like a plum and an apricot and such, they'd have slightly different growth habits. So the trees would look, honestly, kind of funny. If it's all plums on a plum, it'll look like a plum tree. If you bud on an apricot, it's got a more spreading habit. And so it'll look odd. You'll have to do some pruning for aesthetic reasons. It works. They basically look like a normal sized tree. The shape may be a little different because some are a little more outward spreading and some are a little more strongly upright. So you'll have to do some pruning to make sure that you don't get too much weight of this one variety on this one side of the tree, as you would have to do with a normal plum or apricot. But to answer your question, it's not going to be any bigger. It doesn't have to be a certain size to start this project. You just have to remember which is which.
Can grafting be done gradually over time? Could I do a few branches now and a few next year? Or would all of the grafts need to be done at once?
Oh, you can definitely do it over time. So this is a project, as I say, the gentleman in Woodland that I was aware of just kept budding on. If you're grafting and budding are different, and people who are interested in this have probably already found this by looking in various books or online YouTube videos. YouTube videos are great for this particular thing. For grafting, the branch you're grafting on needs to be about the same size as the branch you're grafting to. Does that make sense? The scion needs to be about the same diameter as the rootstock because you're cutting it at an angle or something and you're just fitting them together like a puzzle. For budding, you're making a narrow slit in the bark of the tree that the bud is going on to. You're peeling back the bark and you're slipping that bud in there. You're peeling back the cambium, actually, slipping that bud in there and sealing it back over there. It doesn't matter. They don't have to match. So it depends on whether you're budding or grafting as to exactly how compatible it is with your existing tree. But you can do this over time. Absolutely no problem. You don't have to do it all at once.
Can I keep some red leaf plum branches and still expect grafted branches to thrive? For example, if it might be easier to grow fruit on lower branches and leave the tops fruitless.
Initially, that will be a very good plan because the red leaf plum leaves will be supporting the newly growing grafted bud or shoot. So that's a great way to go, actually, and there's no problem with that.
Three, can I do this in a way that will not detract too much from the beauty of the trees? While they are not the trees I would have planted, they do have a beautiful foliage and spectacular bloom for a week or two in the middle of February. I found a great chart from Dave Wilson Nursery showing fruit ripening times by variety and have not found a similar chart for bloom times. Okay, I think organizing the tree into parts that bloom together might look nicer than scattered blooms. I don't know. But maybe I should just focus on putting larger fruit down low and smaller fruit up high so I don't end up with peaches dropping from the sky.
Not sure how successful peaches will be on this project. I actually can't remember whether peaches are compatible in this situation, but you'll certainly find out. You'll want to keep this tree short for managing it anyway. So this would be a case where a lower branching habit, at least a modified central leader or even vase training might be appropriate for you so that all of it's accessible from a small ladder because you'll have a whole bunch of things ripening at different times. If it's a plum that's blooming in the middle of February, that's almost certainly Prunus bleriana, which is the flowering plum. If you remember it setting any fruit, then it's probably Crouter Vesuvius, which is a very popular red leaf plum that does set light fruit crops. Either of those would be blooming mid-February to the early March. Mid-February is likelier to be that Prunus bleriana. That's before your regular plums and apricots would typically be blooming, but only by a couple of weeks. And so if you bud in a way that they'll be growing in a balanced manner, so you'd have white flowers of the plums and apricots, just as the pink flowers of the flowering plum finish up. That would be very aesthetic. Just try not to make it too much of a hodgepodge. How's that? It'll be a challenge to have it all blooming together. You're not going to find anything that gives you that information. But the flowering plums usually bloom February. The fruiting plums usually bloom late February, early March on my property. So they'll overlap. And by the way, all the plums other than the flowering plum are white flowers. Peaches, of course, are pink.
So just for your knowledge out there, Don has a list, a chart actually, of what fruit ripens what month. Right. And so if you are wanting to get a perpetual garden, this would be a great thing to do. And where is it, Don? Is it on your front page now?
It's at redwoodbarn.com. Now, as he mentioned, Dave Wilson Nursery, who is the main supplier to all of us, has these charts and they are available. They're overwhelming. And so the reason I made my own was very simply that my customers would look at this thing that Dave Wilson put out, which has like all of their varieties on it. And it was too much information. I mean, do you have all these varieties? No. So I made one of the varieties we sell or have sold over the last few years. And even that is a pretty big chart because it also includes citrus and vegetables. So it's there on the homepage, redwoodbarn.com. And that shows you that it is, of course, not just possible, but relatively easy here to have something fruiting in your garden year round, even if you only have room for 5 or 6 trees. But it's there on the homepage, what ripens when. Let me see. Let me tell you exactly what it's called. It's pretty easy to find. And as I say, Dave Wilson has one. It is called Year-Round Harvest Chart. Can't miss that.
That's a good name.
Yeah, year-round harvest chart. And it's the same idea that we're talking about here. We want you to have as many things ripening as many months of the year as possible and as many things flowering as many months of the year as possible. I've done some of the flowering chart type of stuff, but that's a little more detail. So this one will get you going. And as I say, if you look at it, I just had this conversation with a customer yesterday. There are 6 fruit trees you could pick. I have articles on this that would give you, just with those 6, fruit year round. We'll talk about that another time.
Okay. The fourth question we're going to shorten considerably. What are good and affordable places to get scions? Now, scions are the things that you're going to graft onto the tree.
Yeah. And the Sacramento Rare Fruit Growers, or actually all of the California Rare Fruit Growers, is the place to not want affordable. How about free? So you can go to their Scion Exchange. S-C-I-O-N is the term for the top part of your fruit tree. The roots are the root stock, and almost any fruit tree. There are very few exceptions in this. Almost all fruit trees you buy, citrus, stone fruits, pome fruits, and all of them are grafted. And the point above the graft is your scion, and the point below the graft is your root stock. The Sacramento Rare Fruit Growers have a Scion Exchange in February. All of the California Rare Fruit Growers chapters, I believe, have Scion Exchanges. And you can go to the website. Let me see if I can find it here. Here we go. CRFG.org, CaliforniaRareFruitGrowers.org. And there's a map that shows all the chapters and even a map that there are a list of all the Scion Exchanges that are coming up at various times, wherever you are in the state of California. So I think free is about the cheapest you're going to get. If you have a neighbor or a friend with a variety that's exceptional, ask if you can just, all you need is a branch. I have actually, I've got a nursery and I'm selling bare root fruit trees. And every now and then I'll be talking to someone, they're looking for a scion. I say, no, come on, we'll just go to the back and we find one of the trees. I cut off a small branch and I give it to them. If you're budding, you only need a small branch because each bud is a potential new branch. So one branch I give you that's, let's say 18 inches long, will have several buds that you can use. Or you can take that one branch, all your eggs in one basket, and graft that. And if it takes, great. So you can sometimes, if there's a nursery person that's feeling friendly, you might be able to get a piece from them. But more to the point, your neighbors have trees in their backyard, and especially very active group, California Rare Fruit Growers, wherever you're listening, has a chapter in California, has a chapter that you can go to their Scion Exchange. And the people there can talk to you about how to graft them, how to bud them, what's easy, what isn't, and so forth. So that's obviously your starting point on a lot of this.
So Braden asked, when he goes to that event, should he bring some cuttings from fruit trees that he has with him?
They're happy to accept those, but there's a method for how to do it, and there's some things they want and don't want. So it's really important to check in with someone in the chapter beforehand. You can find the information mostly on their Facebook page.
Okay, so that Scion Exchange is coming up, and Facebook is the way to get a hold of those folks. That's better than the website, I'm told. Yeah. All right. What grafting method would be best in this situation?
I think a cleft graft is just easier for people who are just starting out. That's the main reason I often mention that one. A cleft graft is really easy to look up and very straightforward. Budding is more complicated and requires good eye-hand coordination. I suggest that you just try different techniques and see what works best for you. Just remember that grafting uses more material than budding. So if you've only got one branch and you've only got five buds, five buds is better than one branch. So it improves your odds. How's that? But I have to say, it really depends on your eye-hand coordination. I'm terrible at grafting. And I've watched people who are good at it who are just whip right through it. And I would not be a good surgeon either. So.
If I do bud grafts, I'm not going to, but if I did, how many would I expect to take? Let's say I did five grafts. Would I expect them all to go?
You're good at it, 100%. If you're me, 10 to 20%. So somewhere in that range.
Okay.
There's a reason I'm in retail.
And you will know pretty soon if the graft took or not, I
You know, right
assume.
away. Yes, and you can try
And
again.
if
It's
it
just
didn't.
the tricky part is that if you do it when it's hot and dry, it'll dry out and so on. So it's best to do it when they're dormant. But it's the thing. That's the thing. You can try several, and that's the cool part about doing this is that once you get the Scion wood, you can play around and find what you're best at. If you're good at budding, great, because then you have just more options. That's all.
Okay. Well, that sort of answered his next question. Is it unreasonable to expect to be able to do some successful grafts my first try?
No.
And it sounds like, yeah, it could work.
It could work, and it doesn't. And the next question is, does it harm the tree? Not really. You're making a few cuts in a tree. Trees are surprisingly good at healing. But yes, the next part is maybe I should practice this year on plants that I care less about and see if I'm ready for the established trees in the yard. Sure. But I think once you get going on this, I've heard from people who get into this, it's really fun when you start realizing that your buds are working and your grafts are working. It becomes very habit forming. Just going back to our first point, remember to label them.
So, but these trees have lots and lots and lots of stems. It's not like a conifer where there's one stem. No, these got lots of, so just do something on the outside, and if it doesn't work, you can just prune that branch off. Nobody's gonna know.
You've got a lot to work with, and the thing to remember is once it grows, that will become a branch, an important branch. So try to place it carefully so you don't have a whole bunch of them close together, just as you would do when you're pruning and training the tree. But other than that, it can be fun to play around with. And
So
last,
maybe doing the same thing that you do when you're talking about pruning is take a picture of the tree now when it's not fully leafed out, and then print that out and start drawing where you think you want the different things. Plan.
Yeah, plan for the placement of them to grow, because if it works, you've got a whole branch of that one variety. And then the last question is an important one, and I'm going to give it a
Yes.
start. Yeah, go ahead.
I took some cuttings off a plum tree in my parents' yard in southern Oregon. The agricultural checkpoint was closed when we entered California, but it got me wondering if these cuttings are safe to graft or if they should be disposed of. Are there plum diseases similar to the citrus ones that we have to try to avoid spreading?
There's a plum disease back east. That is a real concern. And I don't know if there's a quarantine on importing plum budwood from Oregon into California. That checkpoint up at the border is more for fruit, because there are certain fruit infesting insects that they're very concerned about. Also, like the last five people I know who've gone through that checkpoint, it's been closed for them too. So I don't know how actively they're monitoring it. But I do need to say this. We don't typically want to bring in budwood, or especially fruit, but budwood from out of the state. So I don't think the plum pox virus is present in Oregon, but I don't know. And so my concern would be erring on the side of safety to just get rid of that budwood. I hate to say that, but if you know what variety it is, if you have any idea what variety it is, it's almost a certainty that someone at the Scion Exchange will have that, or will know where to get it or something, because there aren't that many plum varieties that are out common in the trade. Helping people identify which plum they have is something I've done more than once, and it's actually not that hard to do, surprisingly, because they're so distinct and there's relatively few that people grow. So yeah, I would prefer, personally, without knowing for sure the answer to your question, I would personally prefer that you not import budwood of any kind from other states.
And I would say, don't carry that stuff around with you to the Scion Exchange.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Definitely not. So anyway, we have a
Okay.
bunch of interesting questions there. Thank you very much. And we'll look forward to your picture of your plum tree with 150 varieties on it in a few years.
Thank you, Braden. Bye-bye.
We went out to prune one customer's yard. I remember this, and they had 13 apricot varieties on their apricot tree. And I looked at the guy and said, "Well, when we're pruning, sometimes we have to take a branch off because it has borers or something." We actually got in big trouble with one customer because we cut off a branch and it was the pollinizer variety, but it was full of borers. He goes, "Yeah, I know. I don't care. Don't worry about it." Great. If he cared about it, I would have backed off and said, "You got to prune your own tree, dude."
Well, and borers in one branch will be borers in another branch if you don't take care of it.
Yeah, but the
Yeah, that's.
simplest thing that I ran into, this is one when we were pruning someone's kiwi vine, where they had a male and a female grafted onto the same vine. And the male is about 30% more vigorous than the female. She very thoughtfully just took enamel paint and put a little dab of bright red enamel paint at the base of the male graft. That way we knew when we got there, that's the male, the other side is the female. So whatever technique works for you, but I can tell you as someone who goes through this with fruit trees and all kinds of other trees, hanging tags on them, most tags don't last more than a year. The only ones that really hold on are aluminum tags, which are great, but they're usually with wire. And so you need to pad or protect them so they don't cut into the tree. So figure out a way to mark these that you'll know and anyone else will know exactly what variety is where.
All right. Well, we have some interesting questions about January. Wait a minute. It's January? Don, is it January?
Yeah, these are questions that came in the course of
Oh.
one weekend. I used to do this a lot on the show, and it was sort of give you the range of the weirdness that we deal with in retail. But these were fun ones, so I thought we'd go through a couple of these.
Okay, what specific fruit varieties are people asking for these days?
And these two in particular caught my attention: Suncrest and Desert Gold peaches. Now, the Desert Gold, we would have no reason to sell that in Northern California. It's a low chill peach. It
Desert.
only needs about 200 chilling hours. It's very popular in southeastern California, some of the desert areas, hence the name. And it's got apparently good flavor. We have better flavored peaches, and we don't need low chill peaches here. 200 chilling hours. We've already had 400 plus, and we're going to probably end the year around 700 or 800 as usual. So we're fine with normal peaches like O. Henry, Rio Oso Gem, Loring, which get 600 or so chilling hours, need 600 or so chilling hours. And they have, in my opinion, better flavor and texture. She was quite set on the Desert Gold peach. So I did a little research. Dave Wilson Nursery, for those of you who are interested, has all their varieties. And you can then look at each nursery that orders from them, and they list what we ordered. And if you actually read their list carefully, you can tell which ones we actually got. Because there's some that we order and don't get. Those are grayed out. And there's the ones that we ordered and did get. That doesn't mean we still have them, but that means that we ordered them. And so you can go on there and just start looking through the nurseries that are nearest to you and see what they ordered. And you can find even nurseries that don't have websites. There's one here in the Dickson, Solano County area. They don't have their own website, but you can look at their list on the Dave Wilson website. And since Dave Wilson is pretty much the only vendor we're all buying from at this point, you can find that Desert Gold, but I'm afraid, ma'am, you're probably gonna have to drive to Southern California for it, which I would not recommend doing right now. So,
Is that quarantined?
no,
Are
there's no
people?
quarantine on it. There's no
Okay.
problem with buying a peach down there and bringing it back up here. Or one other option, there's a online mail order. We used to call them mail order. We now call them online nursery. Bay Laurel Nursery, like the bay tree, Bay Laurel Nursery has always carried most of the Dave Wilson product line. And they ship all over the country. So if there's something you're not finding at your local nursery, or we can't special order bare root. We put that order in June, and we kind of change it up to about October. At this point, we can try and add on or reorder or whatever, but that hasn't gone so well for the last few years. So it's not like you can come in and go, "I want a Desert Gold." And I'll say, "Good, would you like five of them? Because I have to order a whole bundle and I probably can't get them anyway." You can go to Bay Laurel Nursery and they probably have it and can ship it to you. So those are your options on that one. The other one, the Suncrest Peach. Suncrest Peach is a variety that developed kind of a cult following because of the book Epitaph for a Peach by David Masumoto, writing about his grandfather's peach orchard. And the concern was that, well, first of all, it's a charming book and I highly recommend it. It came out in 2005. And it's about, life on an orchard and growing up in that kind of a family, all that kind of thing. But the Suncrest peach was what his grandfather was growing from the 1950s. And the concern was it wasn't in the trade anymore. It was going to go, as they sometimes say, extinct. In other words, that variety would simply disappear. And he was fretting about that. Well, the book was very charming and it got a lot of play in horticultural circles. And so it sparked an interest in the Suncrest peach. It wasn't gone from the industry completely, but since there was demand, Ellie Cook Company back then, and now Dave Wilson Nursery as well, started propagating it again. It's a very good peach. It's like an Alberta, I'm told. I've never had one. And so it's, there's nothing wrong with seeking this particular variety, but it was going to go away because there were newer, perhaps firmer, perhaps more flavorful, perhaps better market peaches. I mean, that's kind of one of the points of a book like this. Peaches that have been selected for commercial purposes may not be as good as the older orchard peaches or the ones you're growing in your backyard. Well, Suncrest peach is out there. I don't happen to stock it, but that is one you wouldn't have that much difficulty finding. It's a normal, good quality freestone peach and has great flavor. I do recommend the book, by the way, if you can find this. It's, as I say, Epitaph for a Peach. He described it lovingly, says treesofantiquity.com, a great website, and they have a phenomenal product line. Described lovingly by Masumoto in his excellent book, Epitaph for a Peach, as one of the last remaining truly juicy peaches. Although, as they say, this peach is not really old. It is obsolete in our current produce marketing system. That's a good way to put it. Produces a large, round, freestone peach, bright red blush, yellow skin, yellow flesh, exceptionally firm texture, but very juicy with good flavor. So to me, you're describing something that sounds an awful lot like O. Henry or Rio Oso Gem, but especially O. Henry, which is an August ripening peach that does very well in this area. You want a nice, big, firm, rich flavored, juicy peach. O. Henry would be good. But Suncrest is back in the trade almost entirely because of this book. I think that's charming in its own way. The site I mentioned, treesofantiquity.com, does focus on a lot of older varieties, but Dave Wilson Nursery does grow it. It just is a question of whether someone happened to order it. So when you're trying to get a particular fruit variety, the thing you need to know is if you ask for it now, you might be able to get it next January. That's kind of the way the ordering works with bare root stock. So don't be shocked if you go into a nursery and they say, "No, I don't have it. No, I can't get it." You say, "Could you please, Mr. Nursery Professional, could you please order this one next year?" And you might be able to get it next January. Or they might have gotten it. You never know. As I say, you can go to DaveWilsonNursery.com and see who happened to buy it from them this year.
So another interesting question. Well, interesting is not quite the right word, but a January event. Someone came in and was looking through the seed rack and was very disappointed that they didn't have tomato seeds there, and they were looking for Early Girl.
Well, yeah, and that's, we've gone through this conversation now with several people. They're coming in, they're ready to start their peppers, a little early to plant tomatoes, but they're ready to start their peppers, ready to start their tomatoes, and they want to get their Early Girl and their Champion. And I say, I got bad news for you. The well-known varieties aren't going to be on retail seed racks. It just is the way it works. And I had to explain this to this guy. He could not understand this. Early Girl is a good example. It's never, I've been in business now since 1981. So it's never in all those years been on a seed rack. Even when I had a Burpee company seed rack and Burpee had the exclusive rights to Early Girl at that time, it wasn't even on their seed rack because the seed rack industry is totally different than the vegetable garden mail order industry and the seeds being sold to growers industry. They're just totally separate. And what the seed packet companies can get for their product line is different. And in the case of tomatoes and peppers, it can be very frustrating. What I can get, for example, right now from my two main seed suppliers is some heirloom varieties, some cherry varieties, some of the ones you've heard of, like Roma and San Marzano and so forth. There'll be some to grow on there, but no, Champion, Celebrity, Early Girl. How about those Chef's Choice tomatoes? Any of that? No, we order those seeds directly from the kinds of brokers that sell them in order to grow them ourselves for our nursery. And it's just a totally separate part of our industry. I guess that's the best way I can put it. Yes, you can go online, thanks to the internet, and you can find, for example, that rugby tomato that we think you all should be growing. It'll never be on my seed rack. So you're going to have to go to the same people we order them from. Seeds and Such is one that has a lot of those interesting varieties, and we're very happy with them. Territorial Seed, Johnny's Select Seed, Harris Seeds have these things in packets that you can buy, or in units that you can buy, but they're not in a retail packet, and that's the issue. Taking something that they buy bulk, putting it into an attractive display packet, putting it on a seed rack, it's a whole separate process. And there's just not a lot of selection there, particularly peppers, but especially also the better known varieties of tomatoes. It's frustrating, but good news, it's early to plant them anyway. So get online, find those suppliers, go ahead and order your seed. We don't actually even start our tomatoes to sell at our nursery until early to mid-February, and that's for the very first of them. And we continue planting them in our greenhouses, warm benches and greenhouses. Perhaps another show we'll talk about exactly what we do step by step. We don't really start planting them in a big way till late February. Peppers and eggplant need to be started as early as possible because they take so much longer. So if there's a pepper you're really interested in, you better move on that pretty quickly. But you also need to have a very warm place to grow the seed. So it's not the easiest thing for home gardeners to do. However, the availability of varieties on seed racks is strangely frustrating and hard to explain, but it's just because they're a totally separate industry.
So someone came in January looking for superphosphate to add to her compost pile. Why would you need phosphate in a compost pile?
Phosphorus is used by various soil microorganisms, but we don't need phosphorus here. I don't know of anywhere in California that you're likely to have a deficiency of it, nor does your compost pile particularly need it. So this is one of those things, most fertilizers that people are recommending that you apply, I think it's just tradition, not actual scientific evidence in most cases. I've looked at many, many soil tests now. People bring them to me to help them understand them. I've never seen a shortage of phosphorus ever on a soil test that someone's brought in to me, nor have I seen them on soil tests that were posted in various online forums. We're very rarely deficient in phosphorus anywhere that I'm aware of, although someone's listening somewhere, I'm sure, where it's true, but not anywhere in California that I can think of. And it used to be that I would think, oh, well, what's the big deal? Add some phosphorus. It's the old rule we use here. When someone recommends a practice or a product, two questions: is it necessary? Is it harmful? If it's neither necessary nor harmful, do it if you want. Maybe you're wasting your money, but you're probably not hurting anything. That's the way I used to feel about phosphorus, except for two things. It is a pollutant. If you put it on the surface, it tends to stay on the surface. It tends not to incorporate. It tends to adhere to the surface soil or organic material. And then if water runs off into the storm drain system, it carries that phosphate into the storm drain system. That's pollution. It also pollutes the places where it's mined. So phosphorus is not the greatest thing. Also, if you incorporate it into the root zone, we do now know that excess phosphorus in the root zone around a plant can suppress the growth of soil mycorrhizae, which are very important to the plant's ability to take up nutrients, including, ironically, phosphorus. But more to the point, the ability to take up trace elements. So excess phosphorus turned in around a plant can lead to micronutrient deficiencies. We can see zinc and iron and magnesium deficiencies possibly caused by excess phosphate. So let's just skip the phosphorus in most cases. If a soil test that you've had done by a professional soil test lab, if it tells you that you're deficient in phosphorus, well, first of all, I'd be curious why. That would be rather unusual. But if it shows a deficiency in phosphorus, then you apply phosphorus at the rate they recommend. Other than that, there's a little bit of it in almost every fertilizer that you buy, and that's probably more than enough right there. So going out of your way to get extra phosphorus into your soil is not merely unnecessary, but potentially counterproductive or possibly even harmful. Getting away from the feed it with phosphorus for bloom, put phosphorus in your compost pile to enhance the soil organisms. Let's just stop doing that because it really isn't necessary.
Another question from January. I read about ever-bearing strawberries. Do they really bear fruit year-round?
No, and that's a misnomer. Ever-bearing simply means they're not June-bearing, and June-bearing is a misnomer because here they actually fruit in May. So for many, many years, strawberries were a very special thing that only fruited in the month of May in California, April to May if they were early, June in England. The Wimbledon tennis tournament? The classic thing that people eat at Wimbledon at very high prices is strawberries with clotted cream, which takes a healthy fruit and turns it into an extremely high fat dish. But and I've never had this, but I'm told it's the standard thing. And the reason that was such a special thing, such an amazingly gourmet thing to be eating at the Wimbledon match in June, was that was the only time that strawberries ripened until the middle of the 20th century, when they finally found that there were strawberries that were day neutral that would continue to flower and set fruit further into the summer. So we sell predominantly at our nursery varieties like Albion, There's a couple of a seascape. These are ones that they do fruit April, May, and then they keep flowering and keep fruiting into August. They fruit as late as set fruit as late as July, and you're still picking in August. And yes, you can get a fruit can pop out in October. I was out there and found one in late November at one point. So they're not completely photoperiod sensitive. Original strawberries, the commercial strawberries, would only flower as the days were increasing, and that was it. So you wouldn't get them continuing past that one big important crop in May or June in the UK. Here we now have some so-called ever-bearing types. We really should be referred to as summer-bearing types. They don't fruit in December or January. They're dormant now, which raises a second question. What do you do with strawberries in the wintertime? Do you have to do anything at all? The one thing I have done in the past when I've had actual beds of strawberries is take a leaf rake and gently rake through the bed in January. They've lost a lot of their leaves. They're looking kind of dormant. And if you take a bamboo rake or a soft leaf rake and you rake through, it'll rake out the leaves, which takes a lot of the diseases and pests that are beginning to build up by the second year. And it'll kind of break off the woodier crowns of older plants, which are also getting more disease and pest problems. So it's a really simple way to rejuvenate your strawberry bed is to just rake through it gently, not a cultivator, not a bow rake, a leaf rake. Pull all that stuff off of there. You'll be surprised how quickly they'll come back, and it'll reduce your disease and pest problems to the second year. As strawberries get into their second and third years, you tend to get more bacterial diseases, fungus attacking the leaves, mites on them, and the yield declines. But if you rejuvenate the bed with a midwinter cleanup, I remember reading about commercial fields where they would actually flame them. Not recommending this, but they would flame them. They would convert a sprayer to a flamer, and they would, with propane tank, blasting fire down at the ground. And as long as they moved at a particular speed over the whole field of strawberries, can't do this if you have drip irrigation, can't do this if you have plastic mulch, it would fry off all the foliage, but just they move quickly enough that it wouldn't kill the plant. So it would kill off the mites, it would kill off the bacteria, it would kill off the fungus diseases, and the plants would come back stronger than ever. I am not recommending this practice. I'm merely informing you about it, okay? But the idea was,
if you've got wood chips, you're going to have a fire.
Yeah, no wood chips, no drip systems, no plastic mulch, none of that. So the modern methods for growing strawberries, this wouldn't work. But I remember reading about this technique being used in Scotland, of all places. And they
if Scotland is wet.
Yeah, exactly. They could move over the field and it wouldn't, cause a horrible conflagration. But the idea was to clean off all that old stuff, and that rejuvenates them for a second year. In California, just for the record, strawberries are always treated as an annual crop. They're always taken out, disked under, whatever, and then replanted with fresh stock the next year because their yields decline commercially. You don't have to worry about that as a home gardener. Second thing you can do, by the way, especially the older types that were mostly May or June bearing, they start to send out runners right away. As they're done flowering and setting the fruit, the runners come out. You can take those runners, let them root in the ground, dig up those little new plants, move them someplace else in the garden to get them away from the particular disease or pest problems that may be already showing up on your current bed. So move your strawberry bed around. Just take the new plants that form on your at the end of the runners and put them somewhere else in the garden. Strawberries will grow practically anywhere, and that's a good way to keep the whole thing going.
All right. We have a listener who writes, this is Robert. Hello, Lois and Don. I absolutely love your gardening podcast on KDRT. We're a podcast, Don?
We thought
we were a radio show.
We are both. Ooh. We were one of the first podcasts out there. We started podcasting in 2005. It's been 20
years. That's true. That's before podcasting was, well,
common.
Yeah. Okay. I am working through all of your past shows, currently listening to December of 2022, in which you mentioned checking my Simis weather station for rainfall totals, evapotranspiration rates, etc. There doesn't appear to be a station in or relatively near my home in East Elk Grove.
Yeah.
It says east of Highway 99, the zip code is 95624. Can you guide me to which Simis station would be best for me to reference? Thank you for your wonderful educational program.
I would use Fair Oaks, which is in Sacramento County, right? Fair Oaks is closer than anything else I could find. Those of you wondering what we're talking about, CIMIS, CIMIS, California Irrigation Management Information System, you get a stunning amount of information from these weather stations that are near wherever you are. Where I am, I have to kind of triangulate a little bit because my farm is sort of between the Dixon Station and the Winters Station. And it's not, we're not the same in terms of chilling hours, for example, as or other data as Davis is. So I just look at those two and see how close they are. So try to find one geographically fairly close. And I think Fair Oaks is probably going to be your best bet in terms of temperatures, ET rate, especially the most common use for this is looking up the evapotranspiration rate, trying to figure out how much water to apply to your landscape or your garden based on the daily ET rate, which is there hourly if you want it. So, for example, last July, I was monitoring really carefully because I was realizing, wow, it's running 10% above average. So I'm checking daily, ooh, 30% above average. So that means you better adjust your irrigation if you don't have a timer that already adjusts for you. I think Fair Oaks is going to be closest to what you're looking for. Take a look at some of the ones in the North San Joaquin Valley, San Joaquin County, and see how they differ from Fair Oaks. And I think that'll give you the information you're after. Now, geographically, you're fairly similar to both of those, but I think Fair Oaks is going to be closer to your actual data.
One thing to remember whenever you're looking up one of these weather stations is in California, it makes a great deal of difference your elevation. So we're on the valley floor, but as you go up on either side of the valley and you go up into the hills, it makes a huge difference as to what things are. So when you're looking for something close to you, don't just look geographic, but look at the actual
Topographic.
elevation.
Yeah,
Topographic, that's the word.
topographic. Yeah, I was just looking at chilling hours. Now, chilling hours are a totally separate site. That's at the UCANR website. But I was looking them up around the state just out of curiosity to see where we all stood. And there's a really good example of that. I mean, we've had in Davis 435 chilling hours as of yesterday. Winter is 456. Near Dixon, 550. So we've had over 100 more chilling hours near the Dixon station than in Davis. And that is typical, by the way. The orchards in the outlying areas around the Davis area get as much as 100 or 200 more chilling hours each winter than they do when you get closer into town for a variety of reasons. Fair Oaks is almost exactly the same as Winters. Fresno is almost exactly the same as Winters. So for fun, I always like to look at Southern California. I grew up right near UC San Diego. The nearest weather station to us is Torrey Pines. You know where Torrey Pines Park is down there? We lived on the next bluff over. They have had chilling hours this year, zero. 0 hours between 32 and 45 degrees at the Torrey Pines weather station. And by the way, in the last 6 years, that's happened twice. At this point, they were still at 0 chilling hours. This is why my conversations with my father about what kind of fruit trees to grow were very entertaining because he was saying, well, I'm thinking of planting a peach. I said, Dad, how many peaches are you going to find with, let's say, 50 or 100 chilling hours requirement? Well, not very many. They do exist. However, if you know the Southern California, San Diego area, Escondido is inland from La Jolla and Torrey Pines, not very far inland. But as you go uphill from Escondido, you come to the San Pascual Valley, which was an agricultural area. In fact, it was one of the very first wineries in California, was right near Escondido. One of the first four wineries in California was down there. They have had, at that weather station, San Pascual Valley is the way it's spelled, home to the San Diego Zoo Safari Park, if that gives you a data reference point, 543 chilling hours. They've had almost exactly the same chilling hours there that we've had in Dixon. So there are fruit tree growing areas in Southern California. One of the first things I learned when I moved to Northern California, folks up here don't know anything about the geography down there. They don't think there's any mountains or anything like that. It's all, coastal beaches and 90210 kind of place. That's an important part of Southern California, but as you get inland and go uphill, you do get enough chilling for fruit trees. Julian, which is not that far from where I just described, is the Apple Hill area of San Diego County and has lots of apple trees up there. So yeah, topography is hugely important. So as you're looking through those stations, and you can scroll through them county by county, look at the map, try to find one that's closer to your topography. Elk Grove, of course, is the flat part of the Sacramento Valley, just like we are over on our side. So I think Fair Oaks or north part of the San Joaquin Valley will be closer to what you're after. But again, if you've been listening to us and you're perusing through the Simms weather stations, as Lois points out, topography makes a big difference. You wouldn't think there'd be a place in San Diego County that gets as many chilling hours as a place in the Sacramento Valley. But there are, and there are agricultural regions down there where they're growing fruit trees and have been for many, many years. We would go up to Mount Palomar. My next door neighbors in San Diego owned the resort on top of Mount Palomar. They had apple trees up there that were amazing. I had never had an apple like that before. Suddenly, an apple was a fruit that was desirable as opposed to what I got in my lunch bag every day. So, as at Mount Palomar, there's an observatory up there. More to the point, it gets cold and they get the chilly hours that you need for some things.
Well, we have a listener writing in. This is Tara from Oakland. Good afternoon. Would you please advise me on the best way to kill a crepe myrtle? Trunk is about the diameter of a tennis ball at chest height. At my old house, we had a huge crepe myrtle removed next to the house, but the stump could never fully be ground due to the foundation, and I spent years putting herbicides on the suckers. So I'm contemplating doing it this way. Cutting it off at about 4 feet tall, putting some sort of herbicide, stump out, Roundup, I'm not sure what, onto that cut. Then in another couple weeks, cutting it 6 inches lower and reapplying the herbicide. Then about a month later, digging it up and rocking the trunk out of the ground. I don't know if winter dormancy will impede the herbicide effectiveness. Please save me from spending years fighting crepe myrtle sappers.
They can come up quite vigorously, yes. Well, first of all, one of the common recommendations on this that you're going to run into is people recommending that you cut and treat the cut with glyphosate, which you mentioned Roundup, but I've got to say this, Roundup is a brand. Roundup brand has many products that don't contain glyphosate now.
Right.
That used to be that every Roundup product was just glyphosate, then it was glyphosate plus this or that. Now they have a whole product line. You'll see them at all of your hardware stores because they're getting away from glyphosate. I wonder why. And you look at the label and they have other things in them. Well, the one thing that is way more effective than glyphosate as a stump treatment is triclopyr, TRICLOPYR. Many companies make it. You don't have to buy the Roundup brand. There's others that are out there, and it's more effective than glyphosate. So when you see something called Stump and Vine Killer, I think that's the name of the product, you'll find it at a lot of garden centers. And it comes in a bottle with a brush attached to the cap. And so you can cut the thing clean, wearing gloves, kind of dishwashing gloves to protect your hands from this full strength product that you're using. You paint it right on the cambium, which is just the stripe of stuff right inside the under the bark. That's what you're trying to have it absorbed into. It does go in systemically into the plant to some degree, and it will kill it out. And triclopyr is way more effective than other products, including the widely recommended glyphosate for that particular purpose. So I don't think you need to do the three-step process if you're willing to use this particular product. Cut it clean at ground level, paint with that, monitor, continue to cut and paint the new shoots if they do come up, using a very, very small amount of concentrated herbicide. If you don't want to use an herbicide at all, then you get to digging it out. And that's more of a job, but it can be done, especially with one that she says is the diameter of a tennis ball. We've dug those things out on our farm, and it takes a couple hours of labor to get them out completely, but it's just labor. I mean, that's what it is. Now, I've had people take like plastic and try and cover over the thing, the landscape fabric, try to cut it down, cover it over. I guarantee there's enough energy stored in the roots for any shoot that comes up to push up the cover. It'll push up the landscape fabric or the plastic. So you have to, follow up on it if you're going to do this. I know people who have done this. You cut down your whatever it is, you get a heavy duty woven landscape fabric. You anchor that down really securely over the plant, like a 3x3 piece of it. And they put a bunch of pins in the ground to hold it in place. Then you come back in a month or 6 weeks and see if it's starting to bulge because it's beginning to push up. There's enough energy for it to do that. Some trees could simply push that thing out of the way and grow right up again. Tree of Heaven, for example, could easily resprout and just push the landscape fabric out of the way. So you see that beginning to happen. You stomp on it. It's really simple. You stomp on it. You jump on it if you have. But the key is not to let it resprout. There are some plants that are pretty easy to kill. Some woody plants that are pretty easy to kill, just cut and treat, or just cut, cut, and cut. I mean, if you just keep cutting, a plant that doesn't have leaves can't live. But many of them have so many growth buds down at the crown or all up and down the crown, they'll just keep resprouting. It isn't the plant's fault, you give up. So with woody plants, diligence is the key. I've been battling Algerian ivy on my farm for 40 years, and I've gotten ahead of it at times and I've gotten behind it at times, but it's not the ivy's fault, it's my fault. Because I just, oh, okay, I mowed it all down, everything's great. A year later, I go back, all right, look, it's all back. If I mowed it every 3 months as it starts to resprout, I have done that, and I've suppressed it significantly. I've gotten very good control of certain woody plants just by seasonal persistence. I don't mean weekly or monthly. I mean each season. Mark your calendar. And I can tell you, some things will be a long, long, long battle. You're never going to get control of Tree of Heaven because it's so persistent, not just from the buds on the stem, but the roots can also resprout.
So crab apple for me is the thing.
Plants that naturally form a thicket, like anything in the genus Prunus, which includes plums and apricots and cherries and things like that. Many riparian plants have a strong tendency to sprout from their roots, so those will be more challenging. So it really depends on your tolerance for use of a concentrated pesticide. You're using a very limited amount of it, you're using it right where it's needed, and you're using it safely and putting it away. You're not going out and spraying stuff all over the place. You're spot treating. What worries me is when I hear, oh, I had a friend who said, just use, fill in your favorite household product here. Don't do that. So if you don't want to do any of those things, keep this in mind. Without photosynthesis, most plants can't live. So if they can't photosynthesize, you just keep cutting, 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 cutting. It will kill them out. And one thing I have experienced, late summer, after the plant has gone through its full spring of growth, and this is true, I've done it with a peach tree, I did it with a walnut tree, end of July, early August, they've gone into the quiescence period, as they call it in the pomology biz. You cut it down going into a heat wave and they've died. Two cases. One was a walnut we'd been having a lot of trouble controlling, a black walnut that we wanted to get rid of. We've been cutting it back different seasons. Well, I went out right before a major heat wave in the end of July with a chainsaw, and I cut it down and I watched as fluid just came flowing out of the cambium for the next 24 hours. It was pumping up water because we were going into a heat wave. And the plant never resprouted. And I'd been trying for years to kill that tree. So the timing of it in late summer actually made a big difference. Having had that experience, one of my major weed problems on my property, seedling walnuts, seedling almonds, seedling pecans, you know, these are things that come up in farm areas around here. So late summer, one of the things I do is I walk through the whole property, August and September, with loppers and any of the seedlings that are coming up, I just cut them off at ground level. 9 times out of 10, that kills them. Because they're done with their growth cycle. Even though they have growth buds, I've removed all of the energy that they were just about to store for the next year. So late summer cutting back of woody plants can be more effective, for example, than springtime cutting back of woody plants. And this is how you do it when you're digging it out. You excavate around it so you see what kind of root distribution you're dealing with. But once you see, okay, 3 or 4 major anchor roots, excavate them a bit, go out 6 inches or so, chop through them with a hatchet or an axe, not a chainsaw, and get those cut off, and you'll find it digs out more easily once you've identified where the anchoring roots are.
So we end our show with a gardening quote, and this one is from Carol Stocker. Gardening is something you learn by doing and by making mistakes. Like cooking, gardening is a constant process of experimentation, repeating the successes and throwing out the failures.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.